And welcome to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak in for Marty Musk-Hawain. Close to 2 million protesters jammed the streets of Hong Kong over the weekend. It was just the latest in a series of protests aimed at bringing about government reforms. Meantime, President Trump's economic advisor Larry Kudlow announced a possible new round of China trade talks that would take place in the U.S. But Kudlow tied the outcome of those talks to what he called a humane ending in Hong Kong. The president has since said he's not in a hurry to reestablish talks. So what's next for the protests? Where are we in the trade war with China? And what does all of this mean for U.S.-China relations? Jacques Delisle is a political scientist and director of the Center for the Study of Contemporary China at the University of Pennsylvania. He joins us from Taiwan, where he's been following recent events very closely. And also joining us is Jonathan Pollack, a non-resident senior fellow in the John L. Thornton China Center and Center for East Asia Policy at the Brookings Institution. We welcome your questions and comments as well. You can call us at 888-477-9499. Email us at radiotimes@whyy.org, or you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Gentlemen, welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Let me start with you, Jonathan Pollack. Let's talk about the protests. What exactly do the protesters want?
Well, the protesters want a number of things, some near-term, some long-term. In a near-term sense, the expectation, or if you will, the demand, not so quiet demand, is number one, for an unequivocal cessation and for the movement toward an extradition arrangement that would enable the government in Hong Kong to extradite citizens there prospectively to the mainland and other places for various kinds of offenses, real or imagined. That has them very, very agitated, obviously. And number two, widespread calls for an assessment of the violence in Hong Kong, the violence by Hong Kong police against citizens and the like. Those are the two driving forces in a near-term sense. But, you know, all protests have a kind of a logic of their own or illogic of their own. Driving forces here are at many different levels. I would note, for example, that this weekend's protests were peaceful. There were no reports either of actions of a significant sort taken against any of the protesters. This may or may not indicate some kind of breathing room in this process to see whether and when the chief executive in Hong Kong, Carrie Lim, might proceed with other steps, subject obviously to the permission of leaders in Beijing. But this is the stalemate right now that generates this, quite apart from larger long-term issues that citizens in Hong Kong have about their economic circumstances, the ability of younger Hong Kong Chinese to purchase apartments and the like. These are long-term grievances that are not going to be resolved in the streets of Hong Kong right now. But at least for the moment, the end of overt violence of one kind or another, either by some of the protesters themselves or actions taken against them by police, have abated for now. We'll see if that's a longer-term trend.
Jacques Delisle, we've been watching closely the protests and marveling at the number of people who have been participating. You were there. You're in Taiwan. You were in Hong Kong for at least one of those protests. What was that like?
Well, it's been quite remarkable. I mean, the crowd sizes are obviously always a subject of dispute, and so 2 million for the march back in June and 1.7 million for the march just this last weekend. Yeah, we can argue about how close we got to that number, but it is a really giant share of the Hong Kong population. And Jonathan went through some of the reasons, some of the demands that's driving this, and I think it's worth underscoring how they tie into some bigger issues, and that's what's gotten people out into the streets. This extradition bill was controversial because it seemed to many in Hong Kong like the latest step toward the mainlandization of Hong Kong, toward breaking what had been this promised firewall under the system of autonomy of one country, two systems that's supposed to govern Hong Kong since it went back to Chinese rule in 97. And so the concern here is that by opening up people in Hong Kong to potential extradition to China for prosecution for crimes, which ostensibly wouldn't include political crimes, but that's always kind of a fuzzy definition, there was this concern that it would really take away some of the legal protections that people in Hong Kong enjoy as the legacy of British colonial rule and their own rule of law. The police brutality, the police violence really invigorated a lot of protesters. That started ramping up really in July. And there were a couple of incidents that really drove that. One was when the police were accused of being complicit with, and at the very least being very slow to react, when a gang of triads, sort of criminal gangs in Hong Kong, attacked protesters and bystanders on July 21st. And then as violence escalated on both sides, the police started firing tear gas into subway stations and things like that. So there almost certainly will be an investigation into police behavior, but the protesters are demanding an independent investigation, preferably headed by a judge. Bundled in with that is the demand that Carrie Lam resign as chief executive. I don't think that's going to happen immediately because that would create its own mess for Beijing and replacing her. There's also a demand for amnesty for the protesters who are being charged with rioting and other acts. That demand arose when it was pretty clear that people were being detained for fairly minor actions. It's gotten more complicated as some of the protesters did become much more violent. And then finally, this ties back into the really big ticket issue in Hong Kong's governance and autonomy, which is when and where will Hong Kong head toward the democracy that in a very loose sense was promised in the reversion deal, but that keeps getting postponed. And indeed, the most obvious antecedent to the current round of protests were the Occupy Central or Umbrella Movement protests of 5 years ago, which were explicitly focused on this question of how soon the people of Hong Kong would have a democratic say in electing the chief executive. Beijing said not so fast. And indeed, in a way, that sort of played forward to this, because part of the complaint about what's happened here, part of what got these protests going, was the sense that Carrie Lam, as chief executive in Hong Kong, who had been selected through an undemocratic process, was really answering to Beijing and not looking out for the preferences or interests of people in Hong Kong.
Well, you mentioned a number of items there that I'd like for us to unpack. And Jonathan Pollock, let me go back to you. The first thing is the extradition law. Both of you have talked about how that is an immediate goal for the protesters and very high on the list. The law has been shelved, as I understand, but not completely withdrawn. Is there a chance that it will eventually be completely withdrawn?
There's been no evidence from what Carrie Lam has had to say, or more important, from anything Beijing has indicated that suggests it's about to. I think it's really going to be a question of whether under the circumstances this would be the kind of signal to end this protracted it's a kind of an every week or weekend kind of sets of occurrences here. But at the moment, what Beijing emphasizes is less that, it's more their growing concerns that events here, without identifying how, would spiral out of control. There have been warnings from different publications in China that Beijing would not tolerate this indefinitely, although Beijing at the same time is arguing that this is a mess that it is up to the Hong Kong government to fix. Now, that may be a useful fiction, given who Carrie Lam ultimately reports to, but it has relevance here because, from what I've heard on recent trips to China, is there's not exactly a high degree of satisfaction with how Carrie Lam has handled recent events. No surprise there, I suppose. But as Jacques pointed out, Beijing also feels its own hands are tied in the sense that it doesn't want to summarily force her resignation. That would look like it's yielding to pressure from others. In the near term, I don't think it's going to happen, particularly if things stay, relatively speaking, quieter, more controlled. The risk would be from a few weeks ago, when there really was the violence that Jacques pointed out, where it seemed as if There was not a lot of central control over the protest movements, in contrast to the original umbrella movement, which seemed much more disciplined, much more peaceful. But, you know, the weekend suggests maybe this current round is running its course, although that may be a bit too optimistic. All of this ties in, of course, to a lot of the other issues that you raise. This is an exceedingly uneasy time in the U.S.-China relationship. Trump has indicated he's thrown Hong Kong into the mix, as has Kudlow, his economics advisor. I don't think that that plays well with Beijing, as you can imagine. And it may be some kind of way of inducing pressures on China. But very frankly, the Chinese have their own priorities here on how to handle the trade dispute. I don't see a lot of give coming from Beijing about this. There is a real test of wills here between Washington and Beijing. And I'm not sure, based on recent evidence from the U.S. side, that President Trump's claims that he's got the upper hand, he's got the leverage, really are valid with respect to the damage that the trade war could, in fact, cause for his reelection prospects.
Chuck DeLisle, I want to talk about the U.S. response, since we're talking about the president. What is the official U.S. response to these protests? The president's response has been somewhat muted, it sounds like.
I think that's muted is an odd word to use for our current president, but it's certainly been muddled. So we have had from sources in the administration other than the president a fairly clear, if not incredibly strong, message, which is kind of what you would expect. That is, it's really been twofold. One is to insist to China that the joint declaration, the treaty by which the British returned Hong Kong to Chinese rule, treaty signed in 1984 and implemented in 1997, the view is that China must live up to those promises, which include keeping Hong Kong's pre-existing political and legal systems, a liberal set of rights, that whole cluster of things. And this is seen as a set of measures which, in the crackdown on the protests, and even more so the prospect of China intervening, perhaps with the People's Armed Police or some other measures. So they've been pushing back against that. Congress has been doing the same. There's been legislation under discussion in Congress to reaffirm the U.S.-Hong Kong Policy Act, something adopted back in the early 90s, that committed the U.S. to essentially oversee and pay attention to whether China was implementing the promises of autonomy for Hong Kong, and the consequences of not doing so would be that Hong Kong would lose some extremely valuable trade privileges with the United States, be economically quite devastating. So that's the package of what you hear from the State Department and what you hear from Congress. Trump has been, I would say, undermining that in a variety of ways. He's said that this is a matter between China and Hong Kong for the two of them to resolve because Hong Kong is part of China. He's reiterated his respect for Xi as a good man and a great leader and as
Chuck,
somebody who
bring
a humane resolution.
I'm going to stop you right there. We have to take a quick break, but please hold that thought. We'll be back on the other side with more about all things China when Radio Times returns.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowane, and we are talking about China. We have all been watching the protests that have been growing in size and strength over the last several months. We're also going to be talking about the trade war with China, where we are in all of that, and what does all of this mean for U.S.-China relations. Our guests today are Jacques DeLisle, a political scientist and director of the Center for the Study of Contemporary China at the University of Pennsylvania. Also with us is Jonathan Pollack, a non-resident senior fellow in the John L. Thornton China Center at the Brookings Institution. We invite you to add your voice to the conversation as well. You can call us at 888-477-9499. Email us at radiotimes@ WHYY.org or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And Jacques Delisle, you were in the middle of a thought when you were so rudely interrupted a moment ago. When we were talking about not only the United States official response to the protests in Hong Kong, but you were talking about President Trump's response.
Yes, I think I'd mostly finished the thought, which is that he has, not surprisingly, extended to the Hong Kong protest context the sort of thing we've seen more generally in Trump's approach to foreign policy, which is to downplay a lot of the values issues and to have a certain penchant of admiration toward authoritarian rulers. I would just say 2 points to finish the thought. One is that for the pan-Democrat, the sort of pro-reform, anti-extradition bill protesters in Hong Kong, Trump's comments have been deeply frustrating because they are looking for international support for these democratic and liberal values and looking for international pressure to be brought to bear on Beijing. As Jonathan suggests, there's a limit to how much that would work, but it's at least, you know, one of the cards they've got to play. And the inconsistent signals from the U.S., Trump on one side and much of the administration being more forceful, is seen as quite troubling. And I think it's frustrating because, as Jonathan mentioned, this has been a leaderless movement in Hong Kong. That's partly by choice. One of the consequences of the Occupy Central umbrella movement from 4 or 5 years ago was that by having leaders, the leaders then got arrested, and it was a way of kind of decapitating the movement. This time it's been self-consciously leaderless, and that has left the door open to some of the violence that we've seen. And many of the more moderate elements on the reform side, including members of the legislature in Hong Kong, democratically elected members of the legislature, have tried to rein in the protests and worked very hard to get them back on a peaceful track. And I think this kind of inconsistent signaling and such is not terribly helpful to their agenda. They were successful in the sense that this last weekend's rally was very large and very peaceful.
Got a couple of questions from our listeners. There's an email here from Kyle who says, I'm curious what the guests think is the end game in Hong Kong. How much will China take before it acts? Jonathan Pollock, why don't you take a crack at that one?
Well, I think that for Beijing, the idea of an overt intervention, an overt large-scale intervention, is their worst nightmare. Not because they like what they see going on in Hong Kong, but it resonates imperfectly, to be sure, with memories of Tiananmen, the larger consequences of what happened in Beijing in 1989. That would be the worst case kind of an outcome. So they're looking for other ways to, in effect, curtail the protests or not have them overtly challenging on an open-ended basis the claims of the Hong Kong chief executive to oversee politics in this special administrative region of China. So the question would be the degree of tolerance that Beijing would have, and number two, the degree of damage that an open-ended kind of crisis could do to larger interests of China, not only vis-a-vis the U.S.-China relationship, but in terms of Hong Kong's centrality in China's own modernization goals and the like. Hong Kong is still a profoundly important center of finance, of international activities, of corporate locations. These affect Beijing, maybe not always directly, but it affects them nonetheless. The question is, does Hong Kong lose that dynamism, lose that centrality, see some kind of an exit from Hong Kong for the enormous wealth and power that concentrates there? The irony, of course, of all of this is so much of what the protesters are demanding or protesting against is the extraordinary power of the tycoons in Hong Kong who have gotten incredibly wealthy, see their own self-aggrandizement as being a high priority. They are feeling more of the pinch coming from the large-scale protests that are here. So what Beijing wants for an endgame is to leave things as much as they have been. That is to say, the situation where it has the predominant call here, where maybe over time, as Jacques pointed out, you see more and more a mainland-centered Hong Kong, one that loses more of its autonomy here, and that China does not therefore see the need to honor many of the commitments that were made under the 84 arrangement and the ultimate reversion of Hong Kong to Chinese sovereignty in 87. So there's a long list of potential concerns that China has here, but I think they will be moved heavily by the sense that if events here just continue to spin out of control, violence in the streets, what have you, or resume, I should say, this poses risks to Chinese interests on a larger scale that go well beyond Hong Kong. But an overt intervention, I think, is the last thing that anyone in the leadership in Beijing wishes to see.
Before we move on to the trade war, I want to bring David into our conversation, calling from Maple Glen. David, welcome to Radio Times.
Hi, thanks for having me on, Marty. I spent 5 years in Hong Kong as a correspondent for Business Week and know the territory really well. I was there right through 97 and the handover. And I would just, you know, I think I would agree that, you know, the last thing China wants to do is have a violent involvement in Hong Kong. So I think that the best thing for the U.S. to do is to keep a pretty low profile and not try to put pressures on China that make it feel like their sovereignty issues are being challenged. And the thing will probably progress and die down the way the umbrella movement did. If there's other kinds of pressure brought, it can backfire. So I would just say lay low and let it wear down gradually and maybe win some kind of compromises.
Well, David, thank you for your call. Jacques Delisle, would you like to comment on that?
Sure. I mean, I think there is, I would agree with a lot of what's just been said. Clearly, China does not want to intervene. It would be hugely costly to China's reputation. It would be hugely costly to Hong Kong's viability as a center for international finance and business, as a place where expatriates want to be, and so on. So there are great reasons not to want to do that. It is tricky to figure out how to bring international pressure to bear. It is one of the few things that can help protect those who are pushing for autonomy and democracy in Hong Kong, but China is quite sensitive to anything that looks like a challenge to its sovereignty, particularly over an area that is generally accepted as being part of China's territory. And China, you know, the mainland, has been pushing very hard this narrative that it's the black hands, it's the U.S., the CIA, and others are pulling the strings. That's a paranoid narrative, to be sure, but it does kind of play. So everyone would like to see a climb down. I think Hong Kong politics sometimes feels a lot like a case of malaria. You know, it's this kind of thing that chronically comes back every several years when some event forces it. This time it's the extradition bill. Before it was the rules for the chief executive election. You know, before that it was proposed anti-sedition legislation. And so every time this happens, you get something of an eruption. And sometimes there are limited victories, but significant ones for those who want to keep Hong Kong autonomous and want to maybe take some steps toward greater democracy. But there's always this limit out there that Beijing can impose. The thing I would worry about in the current context is that China's really ramped up the rhetoric and some threatening gestures pretty high. It's referred to this as a color revolution. It's talked about this as a challenge to Chinese sovereignty and the one country, two systems model. It's called these people rioters, perhaps secessionists, hints of an element of terrorism, all that sort of stuff. That's rather hard to sort of say, okay, we can live with it. So the hope is it will just die out of its own accord. And there is some chance that it will, a very good chance that it will retreat now that it's gone peaceful. People will probably not keep showing up at 1.5 to 2 million in numbers where there doesn't seem to be a whole lot on the agenda that's achievable. I think it would help a great deal if the Hong Kong government and the Beijing government would allow the Hong Kong government to make some concessions. I think an independent police inquiry would go some way, really killing the bill, amnesty for at least the not highly violent protesters. That would go a long ways toward sort of taking the temperature down and allowing things to settle back to normal, and everybody will live to fight this same kind of battle on another issue another day.
You're listening to WHYY-FM. This is Radio Times, and we are talking about events in China and U.S.-China relations. I want to move on and talk about the trade war, and just by way of sort of setting the table, this is a trade war that has sent some shockwaves through markets and economies around the world. Last week, for instance, the Dow Jones tumbled 800 points in a day before beginning a rebound the following day. President Trump's advisors have said that there could soon be a new round of China trade talks in the United States. They tied the outcome of those talks to a peaceful resolution in Hong Kong, although the president has signaled that he may not be ready to sign a trade agreement just yet. So the question is, what does all this mean for American businesses, for American consumers, and how, of course, is it affecting U.S.-China relations? I want to invite our guests to talk about that and our listeners as well. You can call us at 888-477-9499, email us at radiotimes@whyy.org, tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. As a reminder, our guests are Jacques Delisle, a political scientist and director of the Center for the Study of Contemporary China at the University of Pennsylvania, and Jonathan Pollack, a non-resident senior fellow in the John L. Thornton China Center at the Brookings Institution. Gentlemen, in talking about this trade war, let me start with you, Jonathan Pollack. Can you help us understand where things are right now? It's hard to keep track of who's levying tariffs on who, and what do we need to know about where we are in the trade war?
Well, there are elements here that are less easily understandable, less predictable, given that President Trump's attitudes wax and wane, if not on an hourly basis, sometimes seemingly on a daily basis. I think that a lot of this really began when it was President Trump's decision to impose tariffs on China for his claims about unfair trading practices, quote unquote. As we all know, the president has had obsessions about trade imbalances that go back literally 30 years to Japan. And that seems to be, ironically enough, for him, the driving element in all of this, somehow finding a way to bring down this trade imbalance, even though a lot of this is in goods that are produced for American companies that are manufactured or assembled in China and then exported to the United States. That counts as a Chinese export, not as an Apple export, we might say, or a Walmart export. Trade data does not include service trade where the United States has a clear advantage, because that's not a tangible good, a tangible product. So this speaks to Trump's larger obsessions about imbalances. It is true that the trade imbalance has gone down somewhat, but it's migrated to other places. For example, last year, the trade imbalance with Vietnam went up 45%. So it's a very, very imperfect and unsatisfactory measure of the state of economic activity. The larger issues are not so much the trade war itself, but the presumption of a longer-term technological and economic competition between the United States and China, a belief apparently among some of Trump's closest advisors here that you can find a way to somehow separate much of China's economic activity from that of the United States. That's a very high-stakes game. My understanding is that from the point of view of U.S. Technology companies, it's almost utter lunacy to imagine you could do that kind of a deconfliction between the two and lead China to just somehow operate apart from the United States. And it generates, frankly, a lot of issues in China with the idea that the United States is trying somehow to impede, retard, push back against China's economic growth, even as the Chinese are well aware their own economic model is under careful review and reconsideration, because over time, the kinds of huge growth advantage that China had is in all likelihood not sustainable. But the question is the real intent of some in the Trump administration to try to find a way to quite literally separate the Chinese economy from the United States, to force other countries to make a choice in who their partner will be, make it a very much an it's either us or them transaction. Nobody that I can identify in East Asia wants that to happen. But that's the logic, if you will, that Trump's economic advisors and often the president himself seem to subscribe to. And that's really the larger question that is generating so much turmoil, if you will, so much disruption in the larger bilateral relationship that spills over into any number of other areas as well.
Jacques Delisle, on the question of the tariffs themselves, who's really paying for them? Is China, in fact, footing the bill, as the president suggests, or not? And how are they affecting U.S. businesses and consumers?
Well, tariffs are, as an immediate matter, paid by the importer. So in that sense, they're certainly not being paid by China. The question is sort of who's eating the costs here. And some of it has been absorbed by China. You've seen things like China letting its currency depreciate some. Trump administration therefore labeled China currency manipulator, which is really quite far-fetched. It basically is more fair to say that China stopped supporting its currency. And in a sense, that's China bearing some of the cost. The costs so far have not been greatly passed through the American consumer, and that's partly by design. The early rounds of tariffs, the ones that have been implemented so far, are primarily on things that are inputs to other goods, and that doesn't translate quite so efficiently into prices. One of the reasons we saw a back down from the latest round, the very large round of tariffs that the Trump administration threatened, which was supposed to go into effect in September and has now been pushed back to December, is the sense that this one really would hit U.S. consumers because it would be on things like laptops and cell phones and clothing and the kinds of things that people buy for Christmas. So that's one where I think there was finally an acknowledgement that we'd see a direct impact on the consumer. But over time, you are going to see impacts, and whether it's some of those costs starting to be passed through or whether it is the relocation of manufacturing outside of China to third countries, if people think this decoupling is really going to happen and is going to stick, then you're going to start seeing consequences, and it's just a less efficient world, really.
We are talking about all things China. We're talking about the protests in Hong Kong. We're talking about the trade war and what all of this means for U.S.-China relations. There's much more to come when Radio Times comes right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowane. We are talking about all the headlines that have been coming out of China in recent months. We're talking about the protests in Hong Kong. We're also talking about what's going on the mainland. And we're talking about the trade war between the U.S. and China and how all of this impacts relations between the United States and China. Our guests are Jacques Delisle, a political scientist and director of the Center for the Study of Contemporary China at the University of Pennsylvania. Jonathan Pollack is a non-resident senior fellow in the John L. Thornton China Center at the Brookings Institution. We invite you to join the conversation as well. You can give us a call at 888-477-9499, email us at radiotimes@whyy.org, or tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. Jacques Delisle, the Trump administration has accused China of being a currency manipulator. What does that mean, and is that a fair assessment?
It was a fair assessment of Chinese behavior some years back. It's not really a fair assessment now. I mean, all countries to some degree manage their currency. It's very rare to see zero intervention by the government. But currency manipulator means something fairly specific about adjusting the value of your currency, intervening in markets to give you an unfair trade advantage. And that's really not what seems to be happening here. I think the general view among economists is that China's currency was, if anything, somewhat overvalued, and that what China did partly in response to the Trump tariffs was allow the currency to fall, which, of course, when your currency falls, your exports become cheaper. That has some of the effect of offsetting the tariffs. So it was a conscious move, but I think it's hard to call it manipulation. And it's really just one on the long list of U.S. complaints about Chinese trade behavior and economic behavior, some of which are valid and some of which aren't. As Jonathan pointed out earlier, this notion that the bilateral trade deficit is something that China is at fault for and should address is mostly not true. It's mostly goods in a global supply chain that happen to get on the boat in China, and we blame it on China for a bilateral deficit. This is really a U.S. deficit with the rest of the world. So that and currency manipulation are pretty dicey charges. The ones that have more bite to them are questions about intellectual property theft and protection, China's industrial policies, which subsidize and seek to move China forward rapidly in high technology industries, which threaten some of the U.S. core economic sectors, questions about market access. I mean, some of those charges, too, are overblown, but they at least are ones that have some force behind them in some cases and that do address real concerns for the U.S. economy that are China-related concerns.
And Jonathan Pollack, that leads me to Huawei, the Chinese telecom firm. The administration just extended the deadline for American companies to cease doing business with Huawei. How does Huawei fit into the whole trade dispute?
Well, Huawei is an enormously successful Chinese telecommunications company that has gone from nowhere to a global presence, and both in terms of what it manufactures and the like. Huawei is a major investor now in 5G technology that, depending on who you believe or who claims to understand what 5G even is, sees this as a prospective threat to the United States. The real question on Huawei is the administration intent on, in some sense, bringing Huawei down? Because Huawei, for all of its ambitions, relies to a very significant extent on U.S. chips, other kinds of forms of technological transfer or purchase. And so if the U.S. sees it as this looming threat, what is the United States prepared to do about it? The problem you have here is that Huawei has a global presence. There are arguments, of course, made that Huawei is a cat's paw for various nefarious forces in the Chinese system. Some would have us believe. Interestingly enough, most Chinese, including the Chinese entrepreneurial class, see Huawei as a singular success for the private sector in China. Even if there has been some measure of government involvement in Huawei's success, its real capacities here, its real innovation, are a comment on a very, very innovative Chinese company. So the question then becomes, is the intent here to either A, bring Huawei down, and that's what some of the maximal goals would seem to be, at least if you listen to some on the U.S. side, or alternatively, does the Trump administration see Huawei as a card that you play to induce more of the outcomes that it wants on the U.S.-China trade relationship overall? So it's a central factor simply because it resonates with a lot of China's expectations to move up higher on the value chain with respect to its products and its technologies. It's a global force, not just simply a question of what goes on between the U.S. and China. And, of course, some would see it as a looming national security threat, frankly, in some cases that are unbelievably silly, in my view, claims that somehow with China's advances in its technology, they will embed this in subway cars being sold to the United States, and that will expose all kinds of sensitivities of national security information. Frankly, if anyone is talking about sensitive national security information on subway cars, they should be fired. But I don't want to give too much credence to these kinds of arguments, but you hear them emanating from the Congress. It's now very popular, almost trendy, to find China as the all-purpose villain on matters large and small internationally. I can understand some of the reasons why you have that kind of stance that many take. But, you know, there are real larger issues here about the international economy, how it functions, how trade and technology exchanges function that in my view, really loom. And those are the ones where there are bigger dangers here if we continue to go on a course where, you know, you in effect try to reinvent the rules of the game. Jacques is absolutely correct. There are legitimate concerns here, though sometimes I think they may also be overstated, as Jacques suggested, on China's larger economic model in economic activities. We're looking for the ability of American firms to have a level playing field in China as we try to find ways to move into other sectors in the Chinese economy for American firms. But frankly, what we're seeing in the near term are enormous effects on the amount of Chinese investment coming into the United States. It has plummeted over the last year or more, and parallel unease on the part of U.S. companies to undertake new commitments within China. So that, of course, speaks to this larger issue of decoupling that Jacques pointed out. Those kinds of things don't get the consequences of all of these activities don't get the weight that they should. China is the world's largest trading state. It's the world's second biggest economy. If trends persist, it will become the world's biggest economy simply by virtue of numbers as well as with respect to its advances in productivity. And there is a level of unease in various American circles with that. We don't like the idea of no longer being the unchallenged number one. And that's what a lot of this is about.
I want to circle back to that and to the villain idea in just a moment. But Jacques Delisle, I do want to ask you about Huawei as well, because there has been concern, as Jonathan Pollack pointed out, for many quarters about Huawei potentially being a national security risk to the United States. What do you say about it?
Well, it's a complicated set of issues. I think Jonathan's gotten into a lot of them. As a matter of full disclosure, I should say I've done some expert witness work for Huawei, mostly in intellectual property context. But anything I'm saying is part of the public record here. I mean, I think what we're seeing is this question of, yes, rivalry, a U.S. concern about super successful Chinese companies, whether that success is on the up and up, sort of fair market competition, or whether it is the product of government policies that offer subsidies and protection, is something we can see across many companies, not just limited to Huawei. But I think a lot of what's going on here, and Jonathan's alluded to this, is there just is this uncertainty about where this is headed. And so I think you've got this juxtaposition of two rather different phenomena. One is the Trump administration talking very tough and then often retreating from it. So we see these threats of 25% tariffs about to go into effect immediately, and then they're backed off from because of some promise to continue discussing at a G20 session, or we're now postponing the tariffs for the Christmas season. We see the Trump administration essentially coming pretty close to imposing a corporate death penalty, not only on Huawei, but on ZTE, another Chinese telecommunications company, ostensibly initially because of violating the sanctions on North Korea, but it also has this sort of economic component to it. This is the kind of instability that makes it very hard to figure out what to do, and that's, I think, the business uncertainty that Jonathan was talking about Chinese investment to the U.S. and U.S. Companies dealing with China. That's one part of the story. The other part of the story is, as Jonathan also alluded to, this really strong shift, especially in policy-relevant circles in the U.S., from what had been a long-term consensus that the way to deal with China was to engage China and try to bring China into the system, often with really overinflated promises about how much it would change China into a more purely market economy and a somewhat more liberal polity. Now the pendulum has swung all the way in the other direction, where essentially China can do no right, and it's this narrative of China, the inevitable, intractable foe, and the sort of new Cold War talk. And those two phenomena make for a very, very difficult environment for policymaking and for businesses.
Jonathan Pollack, you were one of dozens of leaders in academia, foreign policy, the military, and the business world who signed an open letter to the President and Congress. It was printed in the Washington Post recently, and it expressed concern about the U.S. approach to China. Where is the U.S. wrong? And I know you've articulated some of this already, but what do you see as the potential consequences of the current U.S. approach?
Well, I've written in a separate paper on the phenomena that we ought to look before we leap. There is a presumption somehow that that heightening the adversarial or quasi-adversarial context of relations with China is the answer to all of our prayers, that we somehow have a new global force that we can concentrate in and focus on. But the problem is, among others, is that there aren't a lot of other people who are enlisting in this effort. It's something that is very much driven by national security forces in the United States, driven by people in government, given by broader views, as Jacques has pointed out, that China is somehow this very, very malign force. But in my view, a lot of this is just almost as if you could wish we didn't have to deal with this very large entity called China when we do. And we do it in all kinds of ways. And frankly, that is what is at risk here. It doesn't mean that we're ever going to have a necessarily an easy, comfortable relationship with China. It will always have aspects of competition. But, you know, it's not clear to me at all what exactly we expect of China. I mean, it's very easy for members of Congress and media commentators to harangue China, you know, kind of detail all of its bad deeds and so forth. But where do we expect this to lead? Do we expect China to go away? Do we expect to be able to de-link China from every economy in Asia? Do we expect China to somehow fall away as a major factor in infrastructural investment in elsewhere in Asia and in Africa and on into Europe? Those kinds of strategic level questions are getting lost simply by the easy, cheap gestures to call China the all-purpose villain. And, you know, we've gone through other cycles with China in the history of U.S.-China relations that have, you know, kind of had aspects of this, but never on this kind of a comprehensive basis that we experience right now, as if there is no particular price that the United States or the world will pay for an adversarial relationship with China. I just think that that's incredibly wrong-headed thinking. And I think ultimately we would find it so unsatisfactory, so destabilizing, so potentially generating other forms of conflict that we'll have to have another look at this. But frankly, the sentiment not only in the Trump administration, but among most of the Democrats who are running for the presidency, suggests to me that even if you have a different a new president election in 2020, a lot of these trends and tendencies will not go away. But that's why I think the need for predictability and normalcy in the bilateral relationship, the regular trashing of China in one way or another, really there's a price to be paid for that if we ask how Chinese are likely to respond to this. I'm not trying to prettify every Chinese ambition, but I am saying that if the leadership of China concludes that American intentions are fundamentally malign, we will see China doing things that we're going to find very, very unwelcome. And we will alienate, frankly, growing numbers of younger educated Chinese who have not seen the United States in those terms. But they will if things go from bad to worse.
Well, we are at the point where we have to say goodbye, but I want to say thank you so much to Jacques Delisle, political scientist from the University of Pennsylvania, Jonathan Pollack, non-resident senior fellow in the Brookings Institution. Thank you both so much for helping us to get our arms around all that is happening with China and what the state of U.S.-China relations is. We've enjoyed having you on Radio Times.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Our producers today have been John Ahrens, Debbie Builder, and Kelsey Hansen. Our engineer is Diana Martinez. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowain. And you have been listening to Radio Times on WHYY-FM Philadelphia.